This time on your weekly Constitutional, can the president constitutionally order a preemptive nuclear attack on North Korea?
It's just simply not true that the president can fire off a nuclear weapon as easily as he can fire off a tweet.
That was Peter D. Fever of Duke University, who recently testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Others disagree with Professor Fever, however, including Stephen Schwartz, who formerly worked for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists.
We are the only country in the world that allocates this power to one person and one person alone.
I'm Stuart Harris. It's your weekly Constitutional, and this week it's about all the president's nukes.
Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, underwritten by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Your host is Professor Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Duncan School of Law of Lincoln Memorial University.
Back in 1787, the framers of our Constitution very wisely divided up something that's commonly called the war power. Congress raises the armies and the navies. Congress declares war. And only then can the president be the commander-in-chief of those armies and navies and now Air Force. But in 1787, the Constitutional Conventioneers could not have anticipated that we would have what amount to permanent standing military forces, and that those military forces, at least since 1945, to have been armed with weapons that can literally destroy all of humanity. I'm speaking, of course, of nuclear weapons. And I'm speaking of the constitutional issue that's presented by those weapons. Who should control them? Well, after an early attempt to place some limits on that authority, it's all devolved upon the shoulders of one man, the man who sits in the Oval Office. And recently, because of escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula, people have become very concerned about whether that's a good idea. We'll hear from two experts today. Stephen Schwartz, an independent nuclear expert who formerly worked for the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And now, first, Peter D. Fever, a professor of political science who recently testified on this subject before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. We recently interviewed Professor Fever via Skype.
My name is Peter Fever, and I teach in the area of international relations, national security. And along the way, I've written several books on American civil-military relations and a particular focus on how civil-military relations shapes nuclear command and control.
You've also worked within the government, haven't you?
Yes, I've worked in the Clinton administration. I was a director for defense policy and arms control on the NSC staff in the first Clinton term. And then in George W. Bush administration in the second term, I headed up the strategic planning cell on the National Security Council staff.
So let's get to it. Nuclear weapons, who's in charge of them?
Well, from the earliest days, there was a lively debate amongst national security planners about how to control this horrible, terrible, destructive device that science had created. And the debate from the earliest focused on civilian control of nuclear weapons. The military argued that this was a weapon and they should treat it like other weapons and under protocols perhaps slightly more tight than other weapons, but the military could be trusted to manage it. And the civilian political leaders insisted that there would be much higher levels of civilian oversight and civilian control of nuclear weapons because the weapons were so revolutionarily different from previous forms of weapons.
I think there was some recognition of that from the very beginning. In fact, I seem to recall that Henry Stimson, who was the Secretary of War during World War II, actually referred to these weapons as changing the relationship of man to the universe. So at least some people on the civilian side recognized that this was something special.
Yes, that was widely recognized. Now, just how special and all of the implications of nuclear warfare, that was not immediately appreciated. It took several decades of research and testing to fully understand all of the implications. But it was recognized from the beginning that we could not treat this weapon like just a more advanced bomb or a more advanced artillery piece. This was a qualitatively different form of weaponry and thus required a different kind of command and control arrangement. In the earliest days, the civilian political leaders insisted that the weapons themselves, the warheads, be held by civilian agency, the Atomic Energy Commission. And then the idea would be that if we ever had to use them in wartime, then the president would give an order and custody would be transferred from the civilian agency to the military, who would then use them. And for the first decade or so, the military were chafing at this restriction and arguing that it introduced great vulnerabilities. And by the mid-50s, when the Soviet nuclear capability itself and their capacity to hold at risk U.S. retaliatory capability grew, then the civilians transferred custody to the military, but nevertheless insisted on various forms of command and control measures to retain a higher level of civilian oversight over the use of these weapons.
That's an interesting evolution, and let's unpack that. First of all, as you pointed out, this is an extraordinary limitation on the military's control.
Of course, what's happened since then is that the civilian custody arrangement gave way to ever larger deployments, and at the height of the Cold War, you had the nuclear arsenal widely dispersed, including on airborne alert.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's a really interesting thing. But before we get there, I just want to emphasize to people who may not understand the significance of the changing in the technology, that perhaps the most pivotal event after 1945, after we invented the first atomic weapons, was that the Russians invented their own in 1949. And it was that interplay between our weapons, which we had a monopoly on for 4 years, and then the advent of other countries getting those weapons, that made us more and more and more concerned about vulnerability to that first nuclear strike. And in fact, there was even an argument early on that unless we had a very quick, capable response, retaliatory response, that we would actually be inviting a preemptive nuclear attack. And so that's, I think, the background to this gradual evolution of this transfer of civilian control to the military. Or correct me if I'm wrong.
No, you're right. And at the heart of it is what might be called the always-never dilemma.
Right.
The idea that these weapons were the weapons of last resort that you would use only in the most dire of emergencies. And so they had to be always available, even under very exacting circumstances, even after the enemy, and most likely the Soviet Union, has tried to decapitate the military command or tried to destroy the bombers before they've had a chance to take off. Even under that scenario, you still had a nuclear option. That's the always side. But because even a single nuclear detonation would be so politically consequential, you wanted high assurance of the never side. There wouldn't be an unauthorized use, there wouldn't be an accidental use, there wouldn't be an inadvertent use. An enemy could not steal a weapon, or a terrorist group couldn't steal a weapon and then have a viable nuclear option themselves. And so you wanted high assurance of the never side. And the nuclear command and control system from the earliest days has wrestled with this, the tension between always and never. You can favor one side, but that raises the risks of the other side. And what you see over the 70 years of the nuclear age is the system shifting in response to perceptions of threat, in response to the changes in the size of the arsenal, changes even in technology, and sometimes favoring the always side, sometimes favoring the never side.
Right. And so early on, when we were the only ones with the weapons, the never side was in charge because we simply wanted to make sure no one inadvertently or inappropriately used these things. Then as the threat from, as you point out, the Soviet Union grew, then the always side sort of prevailed till we get to the situation you were describing, till we had B-52s flying around at their fail-safe points on airborne alert, sort of on a hair trigger, if you will. So did that then decline as the Cold War ended?
Yes, one of the things that, not just as the Cold War ended, but also even at the height of the Cold War, Kennedy's administration came in and looked at the choices that the Eisenhower administration had made and decided that there were ways that they could reassert civilian control over nuclear weapons, maybe shift the arsenal a little bit back in the direction of never, away from always, particularly the tactical nuclear weapons. The Kennedy made the decision to deploy permissive action links, which are coded locks that prevent a nuclear detonation. And when you put them on tactical nuclear weapons, you buy a heavy dose of security on the never side of the equation. And so you're not faced with the use it or lose it phenomenon that might cause you to worry that the weapon might fall into the hands of the enemy or into the hands of a terrorist group. These are the PALs helped address that problem, and that was imposed during the Kennedy administration. And the point is that every incoming president took a look at what previous presidents did and said, you know, we could tweak the system, we could improve it here, we could change it there. Maybe previous reforms introduced unintended second and third order consequences that we now better understand, so we're going to tweak the system again. And if that's bringing us forward to today, it's high time that we as a country took another look at this issue.
That's a great example. You've got these so-called tactical nuclear weapons, which are smaller, low-yield weapons. They're typically deployed forward during the Cold War, perhaps in Western Europe. And the idea is that military commanders can respond quickly if they're about to be overrun by a Soviet tank brigade. But on the other hand, you don't want one of these guys in a use-it-or-lose-it situation simply deciding on his own to start a nuclear war. So they actually installed devices, these permissive action links, which would require a code to be sent to them from the civilian authorities before they could actually fire. That really encapsulates the dilemma. You want them always ready, but never used inappropriately. So that's a great example. That's very important, but throughout all of this, the idea has been, since the adoption of the original Atomic Energy Act, that it was only going to be the civilian authority and ultimately the president himself who was going to be able to order the use of these weapons. Is that correct?
Right. The concern was, would the authority to use this weapon be pre-delegated down, to pick the opposite example, the way that the military have some delegated authority to fire a rifle, for instance, if their lives are at risk. And it was determined, no, the decision to cross the nuclear threshold is a decision that only the President of the United States could make. And so the nuclear command and control system did everything it could to preserve the president's decision-making capacity so that if we ever had to cross into a nuclear use, it would be the president who was making that decision. Now, there was a special carve-out exception of pre-delegated authority under certain scenarios when conditions made it impossible for the president to make the decision, maybe because the president had already been killed, or maybe because the communications links between the president and the nuclear commanders had been severed. Under very specialized conditions, those commanders would have pre-delegated authority from the president. So the president would have already made the decision, but he would have made it in advance and pre-delegated to them to say, if these conditions are met, then you are authorized to do this nuclear option. And that nevertheless preserved the president's decision-making authority, but pre-delegated it down so that in that crisis, the United States would not be rendered impotent, would still be able to have a nuclear option. And this then strengthened deterrence and made it less likely that the Soviets or another adversary could believe that they could, through some clever first strike, neutralize America's deterrent threat.
Which is a real issue. I mean, in fact, the nuclear theorists will tell you that if you allow yourself to become vulnerable to a first strike, then you invite that first strike. And it's really terrifying when you think how little warning the president might have.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And this week we're discussing a rather disturbing topic, the nuclear power wielded by the president of the United States and whether the president really has unilateral control over our arsenal or not. We've been speaking with Professor Peter D. Fever of Duke University. And after the break, we'll talk to him some more. You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week I'm speaking with Professor Peter D. Fever of Duke University, who's been talking about lots of very frightening issues involving nuclear deterrence and the control of America's nuclear arsenal. Recently, he testified on that very subject in front of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Later on, we'll hear from Stephen Schwartz, another nuclear expert with some differing opinions.
Now, my understanding, and you're the expert, so please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that a Soviet ballistic missile launched from a submarine off the coast of Virginia could reach Washington, D.C. in something like 6 minutes.
The timelines were extremely tight. So there is a emergency response protocol that was developed during the Cold War that called on the president to make a decision within a very short period of time, within minutes. The idea would be, if possible, the president would be alerted, told what the situation is, given a range of options, and asked to make a decision. Under the extreme time scenario that we're already under attack, sir, and you must decide now. Of course, thankfully, that never came about. We had some false warnings where there were at least some people in the national command complex thought that we might be experiencing such an attack, but of course we weren't, and it never reached the point where the president was asked to make a decision.
But your position is that now, in the midst of some calls from perhaps some members of Congress or members of the public, that we revisit this delegation, or I should say this reservation of power within the single person of the president, your feeling is that we need to keep it with the president, but that we do need to strengthen command and control. Is that correct?
Right. My position is that it is likely that a review of the nuclear command and control system, perhaps under in the context of the current nuclear posture review that the Trump administration is going through. So to the extent that they have a nuclear command and control review embedded in that nuclear posture review, it's likely that they will turn up ideas for improving the system that would be worth doing. I can't say in advance what they would be, but they would, I think, probably have the character of extending the time that the president has to make a decision. That is, maximizing the opportunity that the president has to consult as widely as possible with his national security team and with other political leaders, if possible, so that the president would not be faced in this, you have 6 minutes, sir, to make a decision, decide now. And I think there's probably things that can be done, some very expensive, like upgrades to communication systems. But there might be other protocol changes that could be done that would give the president a little bit more time to consult and to ensure that if he is forced to make that decision, that he's doing so with the benefit of the best and fullest consultation that he can have. And so I think there are likely to be those fixes. What I'm skeptical about is trying to impose those legislatively from Congress. I think Congress can demand that the president look at this issue and put forward reforms or improve the system and brief Congress to assure them that the system is being improved. But if the legislature tries to impose it, I think that's less likely to produce a good outcome.
All right. The fundamental issue here, and I think the one that people out in the nation and perhaps in Congress are concerned about, and I'm not taking sides in the political controversies swirling around our current president, the concern is that this is simply too much power for any one person to have, and that perhaps there should be some sort of legal requirement that before any president decides to launch nuclear weapons, that president should have to have the approval of some other officer, say the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State or some other high officer of the government, so that we take the decision out of the hands of any one person. Is that something you think would be a good idea or not?
Well, it depends on how it's structured, but if it's structured as a legislative imposition, then it raises pretty serious legal questions. The hoary constitutional question about separation of powers.
Certainly does.
And the courts have been pretty reluctant to intervene and dispose on this topic one way or the other. Look at how the War Powers Act, which is an easier issue than the one you and I are talking about, but look at how that is still somewhat up for grabs constitutionally, but also in practice. Different presidents have responded to a different way, and it has never really functioned in the manner that the legislators intended. And I think that's a cautionary to believe that you can impose a restriction on the president's commander-in-chief authority legislatively. If the president himself said, what we need is a command and control system that ensures that I won't be forced to act hastily on bad information, and so I'm going to want these decisions to be vetted by these groups, and I'm going to want this information seconded by this group and so forth. Those kinds of changes would achieve the goal that you're talking about without violating the Constitution.
Let's get a little bit more specific, because you're exactly right. I mean, it does raise a constitutional issue, but I think we can divide this at least roughly into two basic situations. I don't think anybody doubts the ability of the president as commander-in-chief to respond to an attack. I mean, if there is actually a massive nuclear attack heading toward us, whether it's from North Korea or Russia or wherever, the president is obviously in defensive mode, and it's always been the case that the president can shoot back. Far more troubling, especially in the current circumstance, where there's a great deal of saber-rattling going on between us and North Korea, which has a frighteningly advanced nuclear capability that has really sort of burst upon the scene lately, is the idea that the president might unilaterally decide to launch a preemptive strike using nuclear weapons. Now, Congress, of course, has the power to declare war. So this is a much more dicey circumstance, and one where I think Congress's power constitutionally is much stronger than it would be in the defensive context. Do you see a difference between those two circumstances?
Well, I think that it's actually more complex than you outlined. So let me distinguish between three scenarios. The first one is the one where we've already received an incoming hit. And so it is reprisal, as you outlined. And while you're right that the Constitution is quite clear that the president has the authority to respond, you actually might want some command and control improvements so that he's not limited to a nuclear option. In those settings, actually, time might not be as urgent as the one I'm about to describe. So you have already received the blow, and now we have plenty of time to respond. And it's quite possible that the president, with his advisors, would determine that a nuclear response is not the right one. We have a pretty formidable conventional capability. And so you would want the nuclear command and control system to be optimized to provide that full range of options and not tie the president's hands in that case. Then there's the second option in this sort of scenario, and this is the one you didn't talk about. This is what I would consider to be truly preemptive. That is, we have a warning of an imminent attack from North Korea. And it's not just that they have a capability to attack us, but that they are preparing and about to attack us. And so a preemptive strike would actually eliminate their capacity to strike us or give us the option of significantly reducing it. There's the maximum time pressure constraint. That's actually the most demanding for the command and control system. And that's the one that will have the least amount of opportunity for the president to consult. And in the nightmare scenario, he's woken up in the middle of the night and told that the North Koreans are about to do this, and you have 10 minutes, 15 minutes, Mr. President, to materially change this story. What are you going to do? I think constitutionally, it would be very hard to put restraints on what the president could and would do in that setting. And even if you could constitutionally, there'd be some serious concerns about what that would do to our deterrent threat. So that scenario, it's hard to come up with legislative fixes that would actually bolster deterrence, but also satisfy the other concerns you have. Then there's the third category, and this is the category where it's truly preventive. That is to say, we see a threat out there, North Korea, we have time, not minutes, it might be days, weeks, months, could be longer than that, to address it. What should the president do in that setting? Well, already there's significant restraints on what the president can do in that setting. And the rapid response nuclear command control arrangement that's designed to operate for that wake up in the middle of the night scenario, it doesn't function that same way in that more time permissive environment. I distinguish between when the military is waking up the president, that's the launch under attack scenario, and when the president is waking up the military, that's the preventive war scenario. And in that latter case, it's just simply not true that the president can fire off a nuclear weapon as easily as he can fire off a tweet.
Let's go into that, because I think that's what people are worried about right now. You know, they see this looming threat from North Korea, which doesn't yet have a massive ICBM capability, but it's starting to develop it. And I'm sure people are making the argument to the president as we speak, we need to go in there now, we need to root these things out and destroy as much as we can before they have that capability. So what prevents the president from doing that? What prevents him from simply saying, okay, 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, we're launching?
First of all, he would have to involve a large number of people in that. It doesn't take anyone but himself and his phone to fire off a tweet. So the argument that he can fire off a nuke as easily as a tweet would imply He doesn't need anyone else but him, his phone, but he actually does need quite a lot of people. They would have to assure themselves that the order that they were receiving, the order that you, the hypothetical order you just announced, they'd have to assure themselves that that was legal. What's the legal basis for this? And there are military lawyers and government lawyers at every level that are evaluating these options. Now, it's possible that they would validate them as legal, but now you're involving that many more people who are effectively giving their validation of the president's order. And you would be plenty of opportunity for the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the other senior leaders to weigh in and make their case to the president if they thought this was a bad idea. And if they thought this was a bad idea and the president was ignoring them, there'd be lots of opportunity for outsiders to be alerted, including in Congress or in the media. And so for it to go from the president's idea to a bang would require lots of other people going along with it or actively supporting it. Now, what you're talking about also raises the question of why not get Congress involved? The closest analog we have to what you're describing is President Bush's decision to confront Iraq in 2002, 2003. And it took about a year plus of internal deliberations plus a congressional authorization before we got to war in Iraq. I think in the slow motion scenario that you're describing, those other actors would have time to weigh in.
I guess your position is we have to trust the president. We have to trust the fact that he has advisors. We have to trust the fact that other people in government can weigh in, at least in the less than nightmare scenarios, and hope for the best.
Well, my position is, what are you worried about? Are you worried that the president could do this without consultation the way he fires off tweets? If that's what you're worried about, I think we have adequate protection against this. If you're worried that the president, through bad diplomacy, could lead us into a crisis where we would find ourselves trapped with a nuclear option, that's a very different problem. You're not going to fix that with a nuclear command and control tweaking. You probably can't even fix that with legislative fixes from the outside, assuming you could even get Congress to pass legislation. There's a big assumption here in this discussion. The Congress still hasn't passed an AUMF for the war on updated war on terror, where there's a strong consensus that we need to be doing it. So I think the idea that Congress could act decisively in this area may itself not be politically realistic. Some things that you're afraid of, I think the system now protects us on. Other things, not adequately enough.
Well, Peter, I'm afraid of all of them. Thank you so very much for your time. This has been a terrifyingly fascinating discussion.
Well, thank you for the chance.
That was Peter D. Fever, a professor of political science at Duke University and the director of the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Now it's time to hear a different perspective from Stephen Schwartz, who is the former publisher and executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. We spoke to Stephen recently via Skype.
My name is Stephen Schwartz. I am currently an independent nuclear weapons policy analyst. I've been in the field for over 30 years. I got my start in the 1980s. People know me best as the editor and co-author of the mammoth book, Atomic Audit, The Costs and Consequences of U.S. Nuclear Weapons Since 1940. Which was the first and so far only effort to quantify or try to quantify the comprehensive costs of the U.S. nuclear weapons program from its inception to the present day. I've also been the executive director and publisher of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, which was started by some of the scientists who worked on the Manhattan Project during World War II. And the Bulletin is best known as the keepers of the Doomsday Clock, the iconic symbolic clock that counts down how many minutes we are from midnight being the symbolic end of the world. I also more recently was the editor of a more academic journal called the Nonproliferation Review, which is concerned about the causes, consequences, and control of the spread of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. But my longtime interest has always been nuclear weapons, and particularly the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and even more specialized than that, who controls our nuclear weapons and who makes sure they are used when they're supposed to be, and more importantly, that they're not used when they're not supposed to be.
You've mentioned the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. That's a publication that I've been familiar with for many, many years, and its genesis, I always thought, was fascinating. You alluded to it. Many of the atomic scientists were very, very concerned about what they had created. I'm thinking particularly of a fellow named Leo Szilard and others who tried to alert the civilian authorities and the military authorities that this was not simply a bigger bomb, this was not simply a big firecracker, but that it had potentially civilization-ending consequences. And the bulletin and the doomsday clock grew out of that group, didn't it?
Absolutely. The scientists came out of the Manhattan Project, out of World War II, as you said, very concerned about what they had helped create. The scientists in particular in Chicago, unlike, let's say, at Los Alamos or some of the other Manhattan Project sites, their work was mostly completed in 1943 or so. And so they had a fair amount of time to sort of think about what was going on. They weren't directly involved in actually putting together the first two atomic bombs. And because they were sort of physically removed from Los Alamos, which was sort of the intellectual brain trust of the Manhattan Project, they had a bit more, perhaps, freedom than others did. They're, of course, based at the University of Chicago, which was an open public institution, although their involvement was, of course, secret at the time. And they felt directly responsible for this. And, of course, they had tried to warn first Roosevelt and then Truman about the catastrophic power of this bomb and how it could fundamentally change the world if it were used. They didn't all believe that it shouldn't be used, but they did feel like there should be some rules about it. There should be some discussion about it. That debate was shut down by General Leslie Groves, who was the head of the Manhattan Project, who didn't want any kind of scientific debate or any other debate about this. His goal was to get a bomb and get it as quickly as possible. But after the war, they founded the Bulletin as a way to bring themselves together and also educate the general public about the ramifications of this new and extremely powerful weapon, and a sister organization, the Federation of Atomic Scientists, now the Federation of American Scientists, was formed at the same time in Washington, D.C., and that group most specifically lobbied for what became the Atomic Energy Act of 1946, when there was a fundamental debate after the war about whether the military should remain in control of the weapons or whether they should revert to civilian control, just like the military in general is controlled by civilians in the United States. And they won that debate, and as a consequence, the Atomic Energy Commission was created, which set up civilian oversight of the nuclear weapons program, although its power is very much different today. But those two groups and others like them were very responsible for sort of setting the stage for the public debate about these issues immediately after.
And indeed, the Atomic Energy Commission really was extraordinary. It was tasked certainly with the development of peaceful nuclear power as well, peaceful nuclear uses or uses of nuclear power. But it also had actual physical custody of nuclear warheads. They were not kept in the military arsenals.
Absolutely. For the first years, the Atomic Energy Commission kept our very small atomic stockpile under lock and key. And if the military wanted the weapons for any reason, they had to go to the Atomic Energy Commissioners and essentially beg is probably too strong a word, but ask permission for the weapons to be operationally deployed. This was not a situation that it chafed the military. They didn't want to ask permission. They wanted to have these weapons available when they wanted to use them. So over the years, beginning in the 1950s and then sort of culminating in the early to mid-1960s, the military gained greater and greater control over weapons, starting with the Korean War when we first deployed nuclear weapons to Guam. And then later when they started taking control of them as we put them on missiles and other things that the Atomic Energy Commission could not control directly, to the point today where everything that the military, that is deployed by the military or in military custody, is controlled by the military. The Department of Energy, which is one of the successors to the Atomic Energy Commission, headed, of course, by former Governor Rick Perry today, is in charge of the weapons that are in the stockpile that are being refurbished or are awaiting dismantlement.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week we're talking about the control of America's nuclear arsenal and whether it's really and truly all up to the president. Previously, we spoke with Professor Peter Feaver of Duke University. Now we're speaking with Stephen I. Schwartz, an independent nuclear expert and the former executive director of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. After the break, we'll finish our discussion with Stephen. Stick around. And now it's time to finish our discussion with Stephen I. Schwartz, an independent nuclear expert who's been studying the issue of nuclear weapons control for many, many years. In fact, he's done a lot of different things, including publishing and executive directing the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. He's been a guest scholar and project director with the Foreign Policy Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and the Washington representative for the Alliance for Nuclear Accountability.
When I study or think about early nuclear history, it sometimes seems almost quaint. The idea at the beginning was that there was going to be a very small number of these very special weapons that you could simply put in a closet somewhere and lock up, and that the military would come begging and that you could then hand them over only in very special circumstances and after careful deliberation. But, of course, more and more and more of these get manufactured. We move from the fission weapons to the thermonuclear weapons, the hydrogen bombs, as they're commonly called, and they get deployed, as you point out. I've always felt it was not merely, however, that technological development and the development of greater numbers, but it was the response to the perceived threat from the Soviet Union, especially, and subsequently China, and now North Korea, that more and more control was given to the military, because that quaint notion that you could go to the closet and get the bombs and bring them out and put them on the missiles in time to use them simply became less and less tenable. Is that your perception as well?
Yeah, it was a combination of the perceived threat, beginning with, of course, the first Soviet atomic test in August 1949, and then the start of the Korean War, when it looked like the world was ending from our perspective. That was happening. The Communist Revolution in China was happening. The revelation that Klaus Fuchs had been spying during the Manhattan Project, the Rosenberg case. I mean, all these things coalesced to make it look like, you know, communism was on the march and, about ready to take over the United States. So in that context, the Congress actually initiated a massive buildup of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. At that point, we only had a few hundred nuclear weapons. We were churning them out at the rate of, dozens a month at that point as a result of this program, which was, by the way, not rationally bounded. There was no specific military requirement that lay underneath it. It was simply a desire to get as many weapons as quickly as possible, which did not sit well with the Atomic Energy Commission, I might add, that by the late 1950s, we'd gone from building, dozens of weapons a month and having an arsenal, a stockpile of, hundreds of weapons, to we were building 6,000 or 7,000 weapons a year and hundreds a month. And, around the clock, we had this massive arsenal, and we had many of these weapons operationally deployed on the periphery of the Soviet Union. And we were worried about a surprise attack, as we had been for a number of years before. It wasn't a very realistic threat, but it was one we were concerned about, not least probably because it was something that the Strategic Air Command was considering doing to the Soviet Union if circumstances proved right. And so we did some mirror imaging and figured if we were doing that, then evil, godless communists were probably considering that or worse. They weren't, but that was what drove the program. And so when you have all of these thousands of weapons out there, we had at peak deployment in 1967, 31,255 operational nuclear weapons around the world ready to be used. We've got far fewer today, about 4,000, but that was the peak. So when you've got that and you're worried about a surprise attack that could take out the leadership and destroy a lot of your weapons, you end up delegating a lot of authority to the president, in this case.
There was some theoretical justification, at least, for building this massive arsenal. The theory, at least, whether you agree with it or not, is that the great danger is a first strike, and that you invite a first strike if you have an arsenal that's too small and too vulnerable. So you're actually increasing your own security by having these things basically under everybody's bed, so that the Russians or whoever else could never be sure that they could wipe it out in a first strike, and therefore they would be deterred. But of course, as you point out, if you just keep churning them out, you eventually get to absurd levels. And I'm reminded of, I believe it was congressional testimony by General Curtis LeMay, when he was asked about this overkill. What was his famous quote? He responded, "What you would do with all the weapons left over after you destroyed your enemy 10 times. You need a few extra bombs to bounce the rubble around." And that's the absurd levels that we got to in the late 60s. So, just remarkable times. So it's always been a concern. Command and control was at least initially delegated in an extraordinary way to a civilian agency, in the first instance anyway. But then ultimately, it's all devolved upon the shoulders of one person, and that's the President of the United States.
Right. And of course, the President had the initial responsibility in World War II. But if you look at it historically, Truman didn't actually make the decision to use the bomb. He was more involved actually in making a decision not to use it. In other words, the decision was actually made by Manhattan Project officials and others, a very small committee of people who were working on this long before Truman became president. They presented him with basically a fait accompli that we had this weapon, and who wouldn't want to use a weapon that could potentially end the war? And, you know, he didn't know much about it. Most people didn't. He could have said no, but he did not. And the plans went forward. And in fact, the only decisive decision that Truman made with regard to the atomic bombings was to actually stop them after Nagasaki, when he became aware, A, of just who was being killed by these weapons, but also the fact that the military had planned to keep using them as long as we had weapons that were available for use until Japan surrendered or was destroyed. And after the second bomb, he said, enough, you know, no more weapons dropped without my express authorization.
But now, of course, we have a debate, perhaps prompted by our current president, as to whether any one person should have that kind of authority. And I understand you have your reservations about that.
I do, but I also wanted to go back to something you said a second ago, just to clarify, which is why we had so many weapons. The theory that you mentioned is there is that theory, but it's very much an after-the-fact theory. One of the key reasons why we built as many weapons as we did, both in sheer numbers as well as the variety of weapons, is not because there was any plan. There, in fact, wasn't. It's because we had two arms races going on. We had the one everybody knows about, which is against the Soviet Union, where we tried to stay in a state of superiority, as did they. And of course, when you're trying to do that, you end up topping each other constantly. Mm-hmm. The other was an arms race between our military services. So the Air Force comes out of World War II as the only service that could actually use nuclear weapons because they were so big, they could only be carried on specially modified aircraft. But within about 6 years or so, the Army and then the Navy, then the Marine Corps were able to get smaller, more usable nuclear weapons. And then it was off to the races. They were all competing against each other because these weapons were the key to remaining viable in the nuclear age and also to securing as much of the military budget as possible. And because all nuclear planning at that point was done on a service-by-service basis, the Air Force wasn't talking to the Navy about its targeting plans. The Navy didn't talk to the Air Force, and so on and so forth. And we ended up having tremendous redundancy to the point where we created our first unified nuclear war plan in 1960. Officials were shocked to learn that had we actually gone to war with the weapons we had, using the plans that we had in place, we would have destroyed more of our own weapons than we would have targets in the Soviet Union, and destroyed much more, had much more destruction overall than we actually were planning on. So it's a good thing that didn't actually happen. But yes, to get back to your question, I and a number of other people looking at this are concerned about the current state of play with President Trump and where we are going with the nuclear arsenal, and particularly threats vis-a-vis North Korea.
You think that perhaps some other high official should have to concur before the president decides to use these weapons?
I think it's something that we ought to be discussing in earnest, and not just because Donald Trump is president and he's proven to be, let's say, to be fair, a temperamentally challenged person. We have never had somebody like him as president before, somebody that knows so little about the government, about the presidency, about the weapons that he is charged with using, and shows no interest in learning really much more about them. Now, to be fair, most presidents, when they are briefed about their control of the nuclear arsenal shortly before they take the oath of office, blanch and are shocked about what the reality is. Donald Trump even mentioned this, in fact, in a couple of interviews shortly after the inauguration. And then they typically don't give it very much thought. Clearly, Donald Trump is thinking about nuclear weapons and voicing his concerns quite regularly. He may be doing this because it's part of his sort of general approach to things, which is to beat people into submission until you get your way. Maybe he thinks this is the best way of deterring North Korea. Maybe it's something else entirely. We don't know. But I personally find it counterproductive, and so it causes me great concern. But it's in terms of who should be in the loop, as it were, I think it's worth pointing out that everywhere else in the U.S. nuclear system, in the command and control system, you have at least two people who have to be involved, whether you are talking about maintaining nuclear weapons, targeting nuclear weapons, or actually turning the keys or pulling the triggers to use nuclear weapons. There have to be at least two people who agree that this is the right thing and the proper thing to do, that the orders are valid and so forth. When it comes to our Minuteman ballistic missiles, for example, four people actually have to agree. Two separate teams and two separate launch control capsules have to concur before the missiles that they control can be fired. And if one person out of those four disagrees, the launch cannot happen. On a submarine, you need to have at least the captain and the executive officer agree. And there's a whole slew of people on the boat that have to actually make the missiles ready for launch because they're not kept primed and ready to go in the way that our land-based missiles are. But when you get up to the very top of the chain of command, to the presidency, it's one person, the president alone, who has the authority to decide whether and when to use nuclear weapons. Now, in a normal circumstance where we receive warning of an attack and the military, our folks at NORAD, if people remember the movie War Games, you know, they'll receive the warning information. They'll determine whether it's real or not. If it is, they will alert the president. There'll be a conference, the president, the secretary of defense, any other advisors that he wants to have with him. Senior military leadership will discuss the threat, discuss what the options are. The president will then decide whether or not to use nuclear weapons, and if so, you know, which plan, and then he'll call over his aide with the so-called nuclear football, which contains a book that provides him with a list of options, very briefly described options, given the immense time pressures, about what he is able to do. And he might pick, you know, plan B or whatever, and he'll authenticate himself to the director of operations at the war room at the Pentagon, and then his order will be transmitted down the chain of command. And missiles will start flying, bombers will start taking off, submarines will surface, and missiles will fly. Or if it's short-range weapons in Europe, those weapons will be pulled out of storage, put on aircraft, and launched towards their targets in Russia. It really depends on what the scenario is. But again, at the top of the chain of command, it's the president and the president alone. Now, certain people may be involved under normal circumstances in that conference call, but at the end of the day, it's the president's decision, and nobody can countermand it, and nobody has to agree with it in order for it to go forward. So in theory, the president could decide that he's had enough of North Korea and he wants to teach Kim Jong-un a lesson. And people can certainly stand up and say, Mr. President, that's not right, or this is not appropriate, or even that this isn't legal. But at the end of the day, they don't have any say legally. He is the only one that can decide whether or not that's the right thing to do.
And you think that putting some legal requirement on top of the existing structure, saying you have to have the concurrence, for example, of the Secretary of State, you think that that would...
Sure, the Secretary of Defense. I have a colleague at Stanford University, Scott mm-hmm. Sagan, who has looked at these issues longer than I have, wrote a wonderful book about nuclear accidents years ago, which is definitely a good read for anybody interested in these issues. And he thinks that actually the Attorney General should be the second person in the loop there. But I think it's worthy of debate. It's something that the Senate Foreign Relations Committee started to look at briefly before Thanksgiving, held the first hearing on these issues for the first time in 41 years. I'd like to see a lot more consideration, discussion of that, because I think we've sort of coasted far too long with the current system. I think the other thing that's worth pointing out that, you know, not only do you have to have at least two people involved in any sort of decision with regard to nuclear weapons, but everybody who has any sort of authority over nuclear weapons is part of, in the Department of Defense, is part of something known as the Personnel Reliability Program, which screens you for psychological and emotional and other issues that might render you unfit for duty. So if you are taking drugs, for example, if you're going through a very tense divorce, if a very close relative of yours has recently passed away, if you have gambling debts, any of these things can take you out of off duty until such time as the issues are resolved. And depending on how serious the concerns are, you might even be removed from duty altogether. There are no such constraints or reviews required of the president at all. Again, this is the one person at the top of the chain of command who decides yes or no, and how many nuclear weapons should be used and where. And I think it would be, at the very least, an interesting and useful discussion to talk about what the requirements are for the Personnel Reliability Program and whether to subject the president to that in some fashion during his tenure.
Well, of course, there are many different concerns with such an approach. One of them is constitutional. Is it would even be possible for the Congress to enact a bill, even over the president's inevitable veto, of this sort of constraint on the commander-in-chief's power? There's also the practical question as to whether you're undermining your own deterrent ability if you've effectively made the president have to consult with somebody. Wouldn't that invite a first strike from an opponent, from a North Korea, every time the attorney general's out of town?
Well, you would have backups, just as we have a presidential line of succession now, just as the president is followed around by a military aide with the football 24/7. The vice president is too, just in case. And there's a third one around for the person who's in the next in the line of succession, just in case those two people are somehow, for whatever reason, unavailable. So, you know, I can certainly foresee a situation where if, for example, it were the attorney general or the secretary of defense, you could have somebody, you know, the deputy attorney general, the deputy secretary of defense, and so forth. We already have these plans in place for other nuclear contingencies. I see no reason why we couldn't create something along those lines. As far as hamstringing, we are the only country in the world that allocates this power to one person and one person alone. Every other nuclear state, as far as we know, has many more people in the loop. China has a committee actually involved. In Russia, there are several people that have to have a say in the decision. It's not purely the president's call. And therefore, they haven't been attacked. There hasn't been a nuclear war because of that. So I don't think that necessarily holds. But again, I think it is worth discussing and not just dismissing out of hand as impractical or unworkable. I think it's worth pouring through what the alternatives are and what the potential constraints are to see if we can come up with something that is perhaps better than the current and safer than the current situation. Because just as, yes, you don't want to constrain a president or make it seem as though, you know, there has to be, a formal vote or something in order to make this happen, and you also don't want to have a situation where deterrence is undermined, where your adversaries think that, you know, the president could go off half-cocked at any time, which might leave them to take some sort of unacceptable and measure, such as using nuclear weapons first, which could be terribly destructive and not to mention counterproductive to our own national security goals. So I think it cuts both ways.
Well, Stephen Schwartz, we've accomplished several things here in our brief talk. Certainly, you've terrified a great number of people. This is probably an occupational hazard for people in your line of work, but thank you very much. These are very thoughtful ideas, and we appreciate your spending some time with us today.
You're quite welcome. Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks very much to our two guests today, Stephen I. Schwartz, whom we just heard from, and then earlier, Professor Peter Fever of Duke University. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our production engineer is Chad Barrett. Our music is by Hannibal's Elephants. Check him out on SoundCloud. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, you are a part of the American experiment, which we hope will continue for just a little bit longer.